Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Marissa Cohen. After over 15 years as the premier speaker and thought leader of her industry, reigning National Campus Speaker of the Year, Marissa Cohen has pioneered the field of empowerment training about healthy and toxic relationships, behaviors, communication skills, mental health, and wellness. She's the founder of the Healing from Emotional Abuse philosophy and an award-winning and eight-time internationally best-selling author. Using her personal and professional experience and research, she provides students with real-life examples and relatable content to enhance their understanding and expectations of healthy relationships and friendships, set healthy boundaries, and communicate effectively and empathetically with the people in their lives. Marissa, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I know we started talking about this at the beginning of the year, so it's awesome that it's finally here.
Yes, I know you keep a very busy schedule, and I've had a very consistent lineup of podcast guests, which I think has accounted for us recording this in the beginning of August. But I kind of figured whenever we were going to get down to record this, it was going to be good, and I'm just glad we've made it to this point today. So
I totally agree. I'm just excited.
Me too. And before we get started, got to give a shout out to a mutual friend of ours, Christina Napoleon, who is the author of The Positive Widow and also has a really terrific daughter, Emma. Christina and Emma have both been on the podcast. Emma's podcast, in fact, is going to be released the same week as yours. You're going to kind of be bookend episodes in that first week of September. Christina reached out to me and said, I have an individual, a friend of mine, who I think would be a great fit for the podcast. Are you interested in meeting her? I said, absolutely. We connected and had a great introductory chat, and here we are.
Yep. I love Christina and Emma. Emma's like my little sister. I'm so excited and honored that they felt compelled to connect us. They're wonderful.
All right. My first question is, tell our audience about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions.
Awesome. That's a great question. So what really shaped what my life path has become was my first real relationship in college. It was my first semester, my first month in college, and I met this guy. He was very charming. He was very generous and very thoughtful. He went out of his way to ask me very personal questions to like get to know me. And it wasn't just surface level stuff. He would surprise me with my favorite snacks. He would spend time with me. He took me out on these really cutesy, very romantic dates. Like our first date was, we got sushi on the beach. And then afterwards we walked on the beach at night, right around sunset. Like it was very romantic, almost like it was scripted like a movie. So I fell for him really, really fast. And then things started to change. They took a little bit of a turn. So instead of being 100% healthy and nice all the time and very complimentary, he would occasionally throw in a little jab or an insult, or he would say something to make me feel insecure or small or inferior. And it wasn't all the time. It was like very, very rare. But then that started to pick up and he would say more things that were rude or unnecessary, or he'd make comments about how my major in college would never make me successful and I was always going to rely on someone else for the rest of my life, which was really insulting because I grew up wanting to be and always striving to be very independent financially, And just, you know, as a human, just being a very independent person. So when someone that I really loved was saying stuff like that to me, I didn't take it as, wow, he's a jerk. I took it as, wow, somebody I love and respect is giving me this input. I might want to consider it, right? And so it wasn't a reflection of him. It was a reflection of me to me. And then that started ramping up. So now it wasn't just very, very occasional. It was more often. He would say things that were rude or spiteful or, you know, to make me feel intimidated or upset, to hurt my feelings. And then that escalated and became verbal abuse. And he'd call me names. He would tell me I was stupid. He would tell me my politics and my beliefs were stupid. He would tell me that I was never going to be successful. He would tell me all these horrible things about myself. He would point out my flaws, and he would do it. At first, it was behind closed doors when we were in private, and then it became in public in front of people. And he was basically encouraging other people to demean me as well and disrespect me. And he never stood up for me. And then it escalated again and became way more attacky and way more offensive, and just kept getting worse and worse. And then eventually that became physical and sexual abuse. And I don't want to get too much into it because I haven't given a trigger warning, but my first sexual experiences with him were non-consensual. And that really shaped how I viewed myself, how I viewed sex, how I viewed relationships. And so I started to really, I just felt like a shell of a person. Like I had no value. It depleted my self-worth and my self-esteem. My confidence was at an all-time low. And I just basically felt like I was coasting. And this was back in 2010. So we didn't really talk about this stuff yet. You know, I didn't know anything about red flags. I didn't know anything about abuse. I knew what sexual assault was, but I didn't know that it could be done from a partner. I thought it was like a stranger jumped out of a bush, hurt you and left, right? I didn't know. And I didn't know how to talk about it or verbalize it. I felt shameful. I felt guilty. I felt like I would justify it by saying, you know, people who love each other have sex. Like, this is normal. Stop being stupid, right? And so it was a lot of self-blame and self-loathing coming from that. And then because of all these things that happened, we were on and off for over a year. And when I finally left for the last time, there was still the remnants of that like self-loathing and that guilt and that lack of self-esteem. And so I continued to get into abusive, toxic, unhealthy relationships. They all wore different faces and different masks and did different things, but it was unhealthy because anyone healthy felt abnormal, felt uncomfortable. It felt not right. And so I re-victimized myself over and over again throughout college. And so that's what brought me here, right? Having all of this knowledge and all these experiences and having had to dig my way out using my healing from emotional abuse philosophy, that's what it's based on, is how I dug myself out of this self-loathing hole of abuse and this cycle of continuous abuse. You know, I figured out how to move forward. And my mission now is to teach people in college and adults, anyone who needs to hear it, how to see red flags before they become very dangerous, how to see these behavior patterns and get yourself out and get safe before it escalates and becomes what mine became, right? Ignorance, you know, not having the information disallows you to make informed decisions.
Non-consensual sex can occur in the context of abusive relationships, in the context of relationships that are based on the pretense of love and respect, because of work such as you're doing and because of work that other individuals have been doing who have been victims of sexual abuse, victims of domestic violence. They've been getting the word out that this comes in many different layers. And I can imagine, I can only imagine that had to be disempowering for you to keep hearing those abusive messages over and over and over again. Am I correct to assume that, Marissa?
Absolutely. I mean, if somebody tells you you're stupid so many times, you believe it, right? And I think it was in the movie Pretty Woman where she said, you know, bad stuff's easier to believe, right? He called her beautiful and she didn't believe him, right? She said that the bad stuff's easier to believe, right? So when you hear something, especially from someone you love, over and over again, that you're stupid or you're ugly or, you know, I'm lucky that he loved me. Otherwise, no one would put up with me because of all these horrible things, and pointing out the ugly parts of my body to other people, to me, right? All those things, whether he was saying it and in that exact moment, or maybe he had said it previously, it still bounced around in my head. That's why verbal and emotional abuse is so dangerous. It's like the introductory abuse, right? It doesn't start off with getting punched in the face, but those words bounce around. And so even when he was out of my life, I still had those words bouncing around in my head. So it took so much work for me to be able to stop that noise and stop those words from bouncing around and convince myself that I was beautiful, that I was smart and intelligent, that I was worthy of basic love and basic decency and respect, right? All of those things. But yeah, absolutely. The words being repeated over and over again really, really took me out.
And, you know, you brought up another part in terms of the pattern that tends to replicate itself after you've been in an abusive relationship. You found yourself in other relationships with very similar dynamics, similar unhealthy boundaries that were established, unhealthy messages. And what's interesting, as a therapist, one of the first individuals I worked with was a female in her mid-30s. She had a history of domestic violence, sexual abuse as a child, very low self-esteem. So anything that she saw as being positive or uplifting conflicted with that image of herself that had instilled by the messages she got in childhood and by the relationship she had been a part of. I remember I was in the staff lounge, and when she had something to say, when she was in crisis, boundaries meant nothing. And I'm saying this in a good way. She needed to talk at that particular time. She burst into the staff lounge, sat down, looked at me and said, "Dave, I'm feeling good. What's wrong with me?" And so when you look at, you hear that, it's just like she kept hearing all of these positive validations and treatments. She kept making good progress. She began to empower herself to realize that I could lead the life of my own choosing, yet she still questioned it because all she heard growing up was negativity. And she questioned, "I'm feeling good. What's wrong with me?" And so I had to assure her that it's normal to question having experiences that differ from the experiences that you've had and the image that you've had of yourself. But trust me, you are doing the work that you need to do, and you deserve to have nothing but positive things come your way.
Absolutely. There's two parts to that, right, that you mentioned. One is the cognitive dissonance of the messages that you've heard over and over and over again about all the negative about you and about your flaws, and then having to try and understand or retain the positive, right? It doesn't make sense. It's like speaking two different languages. But also, after abuse, your neurology actually changes. It shifts the way that your brain functions and sees relationships. So, for example, with your client, if she was in a household when she was younger where there was a lot of verbal or physical abuse, she was probably in survival mode all the time. So always in constant fight or flight. Yep. And when you are in constant fight or flight, your brain will shoot off dopamine, the neurotransmitter for joy, at really weird times, specifically when there's an explosion, right? When there's yelling, when there is violence, when there is something that should be startling or scary, our brains shoot off dopamine as a survival tactic. So we're not fearful and like closing in, we're still energized, right? It's like adrenaline rush. Yeah. And so when you're in that, your brain gets used to those peaks of the violence shooting off that dopamine. So when you have a relationship that's very baseline, that's very consistent, that is not like a roller coaster, you don't have those spikes, you don't have those explosions, it feels abnormal, it feels boring, and it almost feels like we're not loved, right? Or that they don't love us, because our brain starts to learn that love is yelling, love is hitting, love is disrespect. And when you're not, because we feel like not joy, but like our brain feels joy, right? It feels very boring. It feels very scary. It feels very abnormal to not have those spikes.
Yeah. And I would also add that love may also be equated with a violation of boundaries too, as well.
Absolutely. 100%. If they're not doing something to show me that they're passionate, right, which is how we rationalize it, or I rationalized it, then he doesn't love me, right? So directly after this first guy, I went on a few dates with this other person who was very healthy, very easygoing. He was very understanding and empathetic. And I still wasn't talking about what had happened, but him being so kind and considerate and consistent and stable felt wrong. And so I left him after maybe like a month, 2 months, and then got right back into an abusive relationship because that felt more consistent and more aligned with how I, you know, those boundary violations with how I perceived love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like you said, it took a lot of work. It took a lot of determination for you to transcend that and get to where you are today, which leads me to my next question about the healing from emotional abuse philosophy. I know this is something that you've developed based on your own experiences. So tell our audience more about this and why it is different from other programs or unique from other programs designed to address this issue.
So I'm a science nerd. I've always been really into cognitive neuroscience and how the brain functions and everything like that. So as I was trying to understand my own abuse and my own journey, I did a lot of research about how we learn, how behaviors are developed, how we perceive things and like development. And so the healing from emotional abuse philosophy is a 3-point system, right? There's 3 R's: release, resilience, and rebuild. Release is releasing that heaviness, that weight, the toxicity, releasing the words that they said to you. It's letting go of all of the stuff that we've been holding on to that is continuously beating us down. Like I said, the words were bouncing around in my head that I'm not good enough and I'm too ugly and I don't put out, so he has to cheat on me. All these things that he was saying to me and all of these men were saying to me were bouncing around in my head for years. And until I was able to figure out how to release that and get it out of my head, I was not able to move forward. So that's the first step, is just releasing the stuff that we've been holding on to. It actually manifests into physical issues too, right? That high stress and that heaviness, it hurts our backs and our necks. It becomes migraines. It becomes all kinds of like cardiac issues. We've actually seen it. We've correlated it. It's not exactly direct, but we've correlated being abused to the higher likelihood of developing breast cancer. So these toxic thoughts and these toxic things that we carry do actually manifest into physical ailments. So that's the first step, is getting rid of that to get us ourselves back to a baseline. Resilience is building our confidence back up. It's building a safeguard, or like a wall of confidence, of peace, of trying to give ourselves that safeguard, right? So it's building support networks and making sure that we're surrounded by people that are healthy and are supportive. It's giving ourselves, whether it's a therapeutic breathing technique or mirror work or some sort of homework, to help instill that confidence in us, so that when people say nasty things, or if, you know, if you're co-parenting with your narcissist or your abuser, they're going to use things against you, especially the kids, and it's making that bounce off, right? It doesn't impact you anymore because you've let go of all of their toxic garbage. And now you have this impenetrable confidence to help you see what they're really doing and that they're just trying to manipulate or control or demean. And so you, it's like a force field, right? It just bounces right off. And then the final one, release, resilience, rebuild. That's rebuilding your life. So now you are free. You have peace of mind, right? You have impenetrable confidence. And now we're finding that freedom, right? We are rebuilding. We're cutting out the toxic stuff. We are making sure our houses are our safe place. We're only filling our lives with the people that make us feel good. right? And so we're rebuilding everything around us using research and psychology and neurology and all of this stuff to help us live a confident, free, and peaceful life.
I think it sounds like a very well-rounded integrative philosophy. I think the integrative approach, whether you're looking at psychology, spirituality, neuroscience, neurology, I think is key to help individuals achieve, you know, their greatest potential physically and also mentally. And I also agree that what we tell ourselves, our thoughts, and stress certainly can impact physical disease. Marissa, stress is certainly a factor in the development of several types of cancer. And you take a look at during fight or flight, you have abnormal amounts of cortisol that's released in your system. And obviously, until the individual's brain chemistry kind of realigns after they've learned to rebuild from trauma, they're going to be in a state where they may be susceptible to physical illness.
Yeah. It's crazy how much our minds and our body and our spirit are connected. You know, and I know that this is something we've been talking about now for probably close to 10 years. Yeah. But really, we are so intertwined. You know, if our psychology is off, if our neurology is off, it does manifest into physical issues. If we're feeling disconnected from people, that manifests into physical issues, right? So we have a really sick society because we felt very disconnected, because everybody is, right now, everybody is kind of in whatever level of fight or flight they're in just because of the chaos of our world, yeah. Right? And I don't want to get into politics or anything, you know, but all of that affects us, right? Yeah. It affects our bodies. It affects our minds. It affects our negativity and positivity, right? And so we are really struggling just to be connected and healthy in that way, let alone our medical system and things like that, specifically in the United States.
Yeah, and being connected to something greater than ourselves, research has shown that individuals that have a high sense of spirituality or religious preference or religious faith, that in and of itself is protective against depression and maybe other forms of mental illness. When you feel disconnected, that kind of leads to all kinds of issues. And particularly if you've had a history of trauma on top of that, that to me can exacerbate the trauma even more.
Yeah. And while I'm not personally very religious, I do agree and respect the sense of community that religion brings.
Yeah.
Right. I think that that plays a large role in it. Feeling like you're a part of something, like you have a community you can fall back on is connectedness. And that is stabilizing and it's confidence boosting. Right. If you are one person floating through the ether with nothing to grasp onto, like, yeah, of course, you're going to feel lost and disconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. The more untethered we feel, the more spiritually bankrupt I think we become. And just disenchanted with life in general.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
From your experience, what are the keys to begin the process of healing from abuse and emotional trauma? What do individuals need to do to set themselves up for that type of healing?
First and foremost, you need to be out of the relationship, right? So a lot of people are like, well, you know, I want to heal and I want to, you know, but I also want to still be with my partner because I love them. And while I completely understand the sentiment, that's not possible, right? Whether you, do you know the cycle of abuse? I'm sure you do.
Yeah. But you go ahead and let our viewers know anyway, because my philosophy on the podcast is I'm the student, you're the teacher. So go ahead and you teach us.
Perfect. There's a three-step cycle to the cycle of abuse. There is the honeymoon phase, the very beginning of the relationship where they love bomb you and tell you how amazing you are and they give you gifts and it's all so happy and everybody is on their best behavior. And then it moves to the tension building phase. That's number two, where you start to feel a little nervous and walk on eggshells and you don't know what you can and can't say to make them mad. And then there's the explosion phase. And that's kind of what I referenced earlier, but that's where they'll ghost you, right? They'll get passive aggressive. They get verbally abusive or they have heightened emotions and they start to kind of unload on you, right? And then it goes right back to the honeymoon phase. I'm so sorry. I'll never do that again. I was just really stressed out. Work has been awful. I have a lot of schoolwork. I only get like that when I'm drunk, whatever the case may be. Yeah. But then you go right back to that tension phase where you now know what the explosions might look like. And so you don't want to get there. And now you're really walking on eggshells or really tense. Like, oh, I can't talk to this person because that really makes my partner mad. Or, and so you're in that tension phase. And then there is inevitably another explosion, number three, right? And so you're stuck in this cycle, basically. And unfortunately, I don't remember your questions.
The process of healing from abuse and emotional trauma, what do individuals need to do if they want to start that process?
Thank you. You have to get out of that cycle, right? And so if you're still in the relationship and they say, I'll never do that again, I'm so sorry, let's go to therapy together, right? That's the honeymoon phase. You're getting right back into the cycle. So in order to start healing, first step is to get out of whatever relationship it is. It could be a friendship. It could be a romantic relationship. It could be a familial relationship. Doesn't matter. In order to start healing, you need to be removed from that person. While I understand co-parenting, for example, or having a marriage with children, you cannot, you can't cut them off completely, especially if there's a custody agreement and things like that. But it's removing yourself from their sphere of influence, right? Or removing them from your sphere of influence. So when you can cut that out and say, like, I'm removed, I'm out of the house, I have my own place, I have my own job, I'm functioning, I have my baseline, you know, needs met, that's when you can start healing.
Okay. And obviously, the need to want to change the dynamics of relationships and also understanding not only the motivation to change, but the absolute need to change. That changing in this case could be really much a life and death situation.
Absolutely. Even the awareness that you're in an abusive relationship, right? A lot of people don't even realize it. It might not escalate to physical abuse. We don't talk about emotional or verbal abuse enough, or spiritual or financial abuse, right? And so the awareness of being in it, and the awareness of knowing that you have to get out of it, then getting out of it, and then making the conscious decision to say, I don't want this life anymore. I deserve better. You know, that's a huge realization. And it's usually a very hard realization.
I mean, you know, the other thing I think that we as clinicians, coaches need to understand is, you know, the first thing that may come into your mind is why doesn't that person just leave if they're in an abusive relationship? Well, it's not always that easy because they may be threatened with physical harm. Their kids may be threatened with physical harms. And also the other part, if they have a pet that has been a comfort to them, regardless of whether or not they've had children, that pet could be in danger too. So one of the things that I think individuals who need to be and agencies need to be responsive to women who have been abused is also to make sure that there's a place for their pets, because their pet may be their one source of comfort that they've had during the abusive cycle. And I think it's also our job as coaches and clinicians to help them develop a safety plan so that when they eventually leave, they have contact information, they have numbers, they have emergency contacts, they know where they can go. But it's a process. It just isn't, well, just get up and leave. It's not easy. It's not that simple.
That you've touched on a few things I want to comment on, because I completely agree with you. The leaving is the most dangerous part of the relationship. So saying, well, why don't you just leave, is so disrespectful and so ignorant, right? Because that's taking control away from the abuser. And abuse is all about power and control. When you remove that power and that control from them, that's when you see a lot of fatalities. That's when you see a lot of horrific violence. That's when you see stalking and threats. You're absolutely right about pets. There's an 80% overlap abuse to humans and animal cruelty. 80% of abusers, 80% of people who are cruel to animals are also abusers, right? Will also abuse people. I mean, how do you kick a dog? Like, how do you hurt an animal? They are literally just love. Like, they are unconditional love. I would lose my mind if somebody tried to hurt either of my dogs. I'd probably go to prison, to be honest. But you see, especially in abusive relationships, pregnant women are the most vulnerable because they have something to lose. And so abusive partners will use that against them by being violent or threatening violence against the pregnant person. And they do that because they know that they have leverage, right? And even children, they'll use children as leverage as well. So I have a safety planning guide because you're absolutely right. If you are planning to leave an abusive relationship, or you know someone who's ready to leave an abusive relationship, especially if it's a marriage or violent, I have a safety plan guide that, Dave, I'm happy to send to you. And if you want to link it to the description of this podcast so people can utilize it however they want. I'm not collecting emails or anything on it. Like, I just want people to have this information. It's 16 pages. You might not need them all, but fill out what you need, because having a very specific plan could save your life, right? And so utilizing resources like that. And for anyone who's listening who might not be in this scenario but knows someone who is and thinks, well, why don't they just leave? If they're hurting you, then leave. That's just not how it works. This person might stalk them, might threaten them or their kids or their family. I've been in situations with friends who are in this relationship where I have physically removed the survivor from the house and brought them somewhere undisclosed. And the abuser spent that whole night knocking on doors, literally knocking on every door. And this was when we were in college. I didn't know anything about this stuff. I knew I was in it, but I didn't realize, I don't know, like the severity of it. I just knew I needed to get her out because she was unsafe. He knocked on every door, on every dorm, in every house from 11 p.m. until 6 a.m., banging on doors, screaming, trying to find her, calling her phone, calling everyone that she knew, calling everyone in his fraternity. I mean, it was insane. And that was a 21-year-old, 22-year-old guy. Imagine that that's an older person who has more resources, more knowledge, and more of a network, right? They'll do whatever it takes to get that person, hurt whoever's in their way, right? So saying something like, well, why don't you just leave? Like, it's not a significant question or a helpful question in any way. Instead, asking something like, how can I support you? What can I do to help get you out safely? What can I do to make your life safe? Because even if you encourage them to leave or say, just leave, like come over to our house, grab your stuff and go. Now you're putting yourself in danger too, or you're putting them in danger, because if they do decide to go back, which happens very often, survivors leave an average of seven times before go back an average of seven times before they leave for good or are killed, you could be putting them in more danger by saying, let's just get out. And they decide to go back. Now the violence has escalated or the abuse has escalated. Yep. And so, yeah, it's such a horrible societal standard. Like, oh, just leave, you know?
Yeah, it's like somebody who's grieving, you know, if they've lost a child, they'll say, well, do you have other children? Well, it's, yeah, I got other children, but it doesn't compensate for the child I lost. And right. It's like saying to somebody who's been abused, well, why don't you just leave, undermines the severity of the abuse to me.
Absolutely. And that totally makes sense. Or it's like somebody saying, if you lost somebody, saying, well, it's been 6 months, why aren't you over it yet? What do you mean? Like, there's a hole in my life. There's a hole in my heart. And it's the same thing with leaving an abusive relationship. The people are not bad 100% of the time. If you went on a date and somebody punched you in the face, first date, chances are you're not going back. You're not going back for a second date, right? I mean, Dave, if we went on a date and I punched you in the face on the first date, would you go on a second date with me?
Probably not.
Yeah. Doesn't matter how good I'm looking, right? That's so off-putting that we wouldn't go back, logically, right? Abuse is a systematic, complete derailment of a human being, right? So there are very good moments and there are very bad moments, right? Have you ever heard the when it's good, it's good, but when it's bad, it's bad?
Mm-hmm.
Very common. Somebody is saying that to you, that's a volatile roller coaster abusive relationship. But those good moments are what we stay for. Somebody said this to me once and I laughed so hard. I thought this was like the best analogy I could ever hear. Are you a Dunkin' Donuts coffee drinker?
No.
No? Okay. So Dunkin' Donuts is very inconsistent in their coffee. Sometimes it's incredible and it's the best coffee you've ever had. And sometimes it's like very, very minor step above toxic sludge. So I will go to Dunkin' knowing that 7 times out of 10, it's going to be toxic sludge. because those 3 times out of 10 that it's really good are so worth it,
yeah.
Right? That's an abusive relationship, right? There are moments that are so good and so beautiful and they make you feel so good and they built this foundation of love that you stay for that because that's the person we know. And then when they're horrible to us, we can rationalize it as, well, they're usually not like that. They only get like this when they're stressed, and we start to parrot their excuses, right? And justify it for them.
Yeah.
It's not all bad. Those moments that are good are so good that to us, when we're in it, when we're not really understanding the cycle that we're in, that's what we stay for. They're worth it.
And you know, you're right. That's an interesting analogy. And I don't drink Dunkin' Donuts because for that reason, because the quality is so inconsistent.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, you look at the concept of intermittent reinforcement, a behavior modification concept, where, you know, where you establish a new behavior initially through continuous reinforcement. But if that behavior is reinforced only intermittently afterwards, that behavior is going to persist. And it's kind of like, it's as an almost similar analogy to what you were talking about. The abuser who was treated well 3 times out of 10 is staying for those 3 times because the reinforcing qualities that were attached to those 3 times that they were treated well were so powerful, it's going to keep them there.
Right. Absolutely. And especially because you don't come out the gate getting hit. You don't come out the gate getting demeaned. Right. They build a foundation of love and respect and kindness. And that's what we crave. Right. We crave that connectedness. That's the person that we know. And as they slowly disappear into the person that they truly are. Right. It's easier to see it as this is temporary because we know the real them. But really, now in the bad moments when they're showing us who they really are.
Absolutely. And you know, the other thing you had mentioned in terms of asking questions to an abused individual in a way that's going to be empowering, that's not going to be judgmental, particularly if they're dealing with a male therapist and their abuser's a male, if you come across as condescending or judgmental, that's just going to recreate abuse dynamics. So it's important for us, I think, to understand as therapists that we need to have a very neutral approach, non-judgmental approach. What can we do to help you? What do you need from us at this particular moment in time? How can we develop a safety plan that's going to work with your timeline and it's going to be something that you're comfortable with? What can we do to empower you in the meantime? So at least that you can develop some resilience in a situation that is not a good situation, leading up to that point where we can finally talk about you leaving the relationship and finding a community of support.
Absolutely. And I think coming from a therapeutic perspective, giving the survivor control of their situation is number one, right? Not telling them what they need to be doing or what they should be doing, but offering empathetic questions like, how can I support you? What do you need right now? They know their situation better than anyone, right? Yep. Even from a textbook, you don't know better what they're going through, what they're feeling, than they do being feet on the ground in it, right? So telling them what they need to be doing is continuing to take away that control from them. In their world, they already are powerless and have no control over what's happening to them, especially if it's physically or sexually abusive. There is no control. And by telling them what they need to be doing, you are continuing that removal of control over their own environment, over their choices, over their autonomy. And so as a therapist or a counselor or a social worker, the best thing you can do is let them lead. Let them tell you what they need and you just do that. Don't do more. Don't do less. Just do that.
Absolutely. Let them lead you where they're comfortable leading you. Whatever door they open up for you, that's the door you walk through.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think sage advice that you've given us as coaches and clinicians in terms of how to hold space for individuals who have been in abusive relationships. Now, I want to shift a little bit to your speaking and what you do with college campuses. That's a very integral part of who you are and what you do. So what is your mission as a speaker? What do you want to empower college students to understand? And my other question is, What percentage of college students are in abusive relationships or have been abused or the victims of sexual abuse, emotional abuse, or any other kind of abuse for that matter?
There are a lot of statistics you just covered. 57% of college students are in or will be in an abusive relationship. I think that equated to about 1.5 million women in college. Most sexual abuse happens between August and November. About 50% of sexual assaults in college happen in the first semester. It's about 1 in 2 women and 1 in 4 men in their lifetime will be abused. College women have a much higher, I think a 3 times higher likelihood of being sexually abused than the same age group women outside of college who don't go to college. The statistics about college and sexual abuse and, you know, relationship abuse is just insane. And that is partially because it has been historically mishandled or brushed under the rug. Another interesting statistic is about 27.4% of survivors of college sexual abuse will drop out of college and never go back. And only about 7% of people who have survived sexual abuse will seek out resources, which is scary low, right? They usually just sit in it because we didn't know that there were resources, or it's not talked about enough, or we feel shameful and guilty and self-loathing, right? So there's so much that happens. You lose who you are and you find yourself trying to figure out how to get back to who you were. Yeah. When your biology and neurology have changed and you're no longer that person, you have to figure out who you are now. These are messages that we don't give to students. So my goal, my mission for working with colleges is to empower students to see red flags before they escalate and become horrible or before they become dangerous, right? Even to see yellow flags, which are like those instinctual warning signs when somebody is rude to a server on a first date, right? That's a yellow flag. Is it inherently dangerous to you right now? No. Is that a threat to you right now? No, but that's a behavior pattern that needs to be watched, right? Or if they talk about people in a hostile way, like, ugh, you know, all my exes are crazy. How does that make you feel, right? That makes you feel a little funny, like something's not right. So recognizing those yellow flags before they become red flags and recognizing the red flags before they become inherently dangerous. So that's really my goal. I want to empower students to have and expect healthy relationships. I want them to be healthy partners and only have healthy partners.
Yeah, I think anything we can do to empower the young adults of America are going to be key, particularly, as you mentioned, in the environment that we're living in now. I think it's extremely key. It's interesting that you mentioned that the majority of abuse occurs between August and November. I also read somewhere that, you know, suicide attempts and suicidality in college students is particularly a problem area, that many college students will complete suicide at the age of 19 in their second semester of their freshman year. So yeah, I wonder how much of a correlation there is between suicidal ideation and individuals who are victims of abuse.
Significantly, it's significant. I myself had suicidal ideations. I never made an attempt or a plan, but I had a box cutter in my jewelry box. I was very close. And there were times where I just felt so overwhelmed by unprocessed and not understandable emotions at that time. And I know a lot of people that had similar experiences. There's a huge correlation between being victimized by abuse and sexual assault and suicidal ideations, attempts, and plans.
And I think coupled with the other pressures that college students are dealing with financially, dealing with in terms of trying to fit in with peer groups, challenges with decision-making, and their decision-making prowess gets better with age, and it's still developing at that age. I can imagine that you throw abuse in the mix, that's got to be overwhelming.
I mean, they surveyed college students on their anxiety levels and their stress levels and then compared it to specifically men in their 40s with families in the workforce. And they were almost identical stress levels. So college students nowadays with the competition, with all of the things that go into college, whether it's financial or carrying too much of a load and trying to figure out how to navigate living independently and time management and having a job and all these other responsibilities, is equivalent to a 40-year-old with a family trying to make sure that their family is fed and that they can pay their mortgage. That's sickening to me. Like, it shouldn't be at 19 years old that stressful to live, right? It shouldn't be that overwhelming to function. Not because college shouldn't be competitive. It should absolutely be competitive and challenging. But to put that much on the plate of a person who is not emotionally equipped to handle that level of stress, of course our suicide rates have skyrocketed, putting them at such a disadvantage.
Absolutely. And again, we need to give them as much of an advantage as possible. And the other concern I always have is a resource issue. And I've said this on other podcasts that I've guested on. I've said this on this podcast, is that there's always more individuals who need services than there are services to be able to provide it. So there's always been that type of resource issue ever since I've been in the human service field. And that's been, you know, since the 1980s. So hopefully with what you're doing, we can supplement and add to that resource list for students. What has been the response of college students to your message? And what do you find most rewarding about working with them?
My gosh. Well, rewarding, just being able to have the opportunity to talk to students about the stuff that they need to be aware of, like, is so fulfilling for me. I aspired to be the person I needed when I was going through it. And I like to think that that's who I've become to them. You know, I've had a very positive response. Not an event has gone by, and I probably visit over 100 campuses a year, have over 100 events a year around the country, and I'm actually expanding outside of the country now with military bases as well. It's been overwhelmingly positive. I've not had an event yet where someone hasn't come and spoken to me after my program and either shared a story, thanked me for being there without disclosing, but subtly disclosed. It's so prevalent. It's so common. And the fact that it's 2025, 8 years past the Me Too movement, and people still feel like they can't talk to anyone about it, like, breaks my heart. There's so much more work to be done. There's so many more people that could share their stories and help other people and be relatable to one person. If you share your story and one person responds to it, you may have saved a life. And so I'm just grateful every day that I have these opportunities and that schools and students trust me with these messages and are eager to keep their students safe.
And I think each individual that responds to an individual's story of trauma or challenge, and that's one person closer to creating the community that we need to support individuals who are going through challenges. So each person that responds creates that community of support.
Absolutely. I only have the statistics about male perpetrators, but there are perpetrators outside of being male, other genders. Anyone can be a perpetrator and anyone can be a survivor. I just want to say that. I believe the statistics as per 2016 were that 9% of males are perpetrators. But of that 9%, 86% of those people will hurt six or more people, right? So if you think about it, it's a small number of people who are hurting, who are perpetrating, who are abusing. And then if you think about if each of them hurt six people, our survivor community is almost six times as big, but we're silenced, right? We're quiet. We're feeling like we are to blame and like we are alone. But if everybody speaks their truth, tells their story, you're right. Bringing one more person into this community strengthens us, and we outnumber them 6-1. Yeah. So the more people that speak about it, the more people that share their stories, you're just empowering this community to feel safe, to fight back, and to hold perpetrators accountable, which is ultimately what we want, right? If we can hold them accountable, because only about 2% of perpetrators spend one night in jail, if we can hold them accountable and put them all away, we will have a significantly safer, happier community and society.
Absolutely. And I think there's always been a stigma around asking for help. And I think, as you mentioned, there's a lot of self-loathing and blame that the victim of abuse puts on themselves, thinking that there's something that they did to cause it, which also, I would imagine, perpetrates a lot of shame-based thinking. And that, I think, is also maybe an inhibiting factor for that individual coming forward and asking for help as well, too. So,
absolutely. Like I said, 7%, only 7% of survivors seek out resources. We feel very isolated, yep. Right? That's the whole goal of abuse, is to isolate us. And if we're alone, we'll stay. Or, you know, if we are isolated and feel like we don't have a place to go, we're not going to speak out. And that person then continues to get away with this bad behavior. And so knowing that it's all intentional, that the isolation and the demeaning is in an effort to keep themselves safe, right? Speaking out is doing the opposite of that. It's keeping yourself safe.
Absolutely.
Other people.
And just because individuals, whether they're males, females, make bad relationships decisions that put them in a situation where they're the victims of abuse, does not make them flawed people. They made what turned out to be a not healthy decision, but it doesn't mean that person themselves is flawed or unhealthy. They're still inherently beautiful. What we need to recognize is that we're dealing with the breaking that cycle, that toxic cycle that has led individuals to not lead the life that they of their own choosing.
Right. The perpetrator is the one who makes the choice. The survivor or the victim is the one who bears the consequences of a perpetrator's behavior, right? So the perpetrator is always to blame. The victim or the survivor does not have the choice, right? Whether they were awake or unconscious or drunk or sober or wearing a skirt or naked or whatever. It doesn't matter. A choice was made that impacted them. And the person who deserves to wear the consequences are the perpetrator. They're usually the one that are not held accountable. And we turn to the survivor and say, well, what were you wearing? Or, well, you were drinking, or you were flirty, and you know what that person's like. That's all victim blaming. And the more we victim blame, the quieter our community gets, versus the more we lead with empathy, the quieter and the more, you know, pigeonholed perpetrators become. And that's what we want. We want to corner them, and we want them to be held accountable and send a message that we're not taking this anymore. We're not allowing them to continue to perpetrate and hurt people. And that whether you are a survivor in the community or an advocate in the community, perpetrators are not welcome here.
Absolutely. We could go on for probably about another hour or so. Solving the problems of the world. They're trying to find ways to effectively deal with individuals who have been in abusive relationships. But I do have a couple of more questions for you before we say goodbye for now, or so long. If you're going to leave our audience with one ultimate takeaway from today, one thing you want to leave our audience with, Marissa, what would that be?
My goodness. So can I do it in two different ways?
You can do it in three different ways. You are so empowered. How's that?
I appreciate you. So if you're listening and you're a survivor, you're not alone. If one in two women and one in three men and one in two bisexual and one and a half trans people, like, all experience this stuff, my goodness, you are not alone. The best thing you can do is speak about it. Find someone you trust and tell them your story. Or if it's more comfortable, find a stranger and tell them your story. Whether it's a therapist or a person sitting on a park bench, it doesn't matter. The more you talk about it, the easier it becomes to deal with it, right? The first time I spoke about it, I was mid-panic attack with my best friend while driving a car. Naturally, very unsafe place to start talking about it, but we safely pulled the car over with her help, and I was able to just unload. And this was 6 months after it happened, you know? And so I wasn't talking about it, and I was holding it in. And then the second time I spoke about it was a couple years later. And then it became easier and easier and easier. And now I can speak about my story with no problems. It doesn't even feel like it doesn't impact me as much anymore. I've taken the power out of it. So my advice for survivors is speak about it. Tell your story to whoever will listen, whoever you're comfortable with, make that decision. For advocates, I've already said my takeaway. Give the person in your life dealing with this control of their situation and be an avenue of support. It doesn't matter if they want to go to therapy or they don't want to go to therapy. It doesn't matter if they are ready to leave or are not ready to leave. You don't get to tell them what to do. You don't get to tell them how to live their lives because you are not in their shoes. You don't understand. So give them control, but be there as an avenue of support so that when they are ready to leave or they are ready to go get therapy or they are ready to do whatever it is, you are number one on their list to reach out to. You want to be a safe place for them.
Yep. And you want to be a co-companion on their journey to health and wellness. And you know, you're right. If you tell somebody what to do, they're probably not going to listen to you anyway. And particularly if they've come out of a relationship where they've had a history of relationships, where they've had ambivalent history with authority figures. And typically for a child, the authority figures are most ambivalent about are their parents. So, and then if that cycle isn't interrupted, they're going to carry that into adulthood, into their relationships, into their interactions with anybody in society. So empowerment as opposed to directing.
Yes,
is the best move.
And for parents, you just said something that sparked this thought. For parents of people who have experienced any type of this type of trauma, if your kid says not to do something, don't do it. Right. So with my first abuser, we were in a relationship. So my parents knew him and my mom was gung-ho. She wanted to write a letter to his mom and tell her everything that he had done to me and be like descriptive and be hurtful so that she knows what her son is doing to people. And I begged my mom not to do it because I knew that it wouldn't be effective and B, it'd be putting me in more of an unsafe place, right? So even if you are a parent and you love your kid and it's all out of advocacy and love and you want to do it because you think you know best, listen to your kid. If your kid does not want you to do that, don't do it. It took me convincing my mom for weeks, begging her not to write a letter before she finally was like, fine, I won't write the letter. But she would have, and it would have put me in a way worse position.
And we as advocates can't take any action that's going to set up the victim for more abuse.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Marissa, my last question. People want to contact you, find out where in the country or the world you're at next. What's the best way for them to do that?
There's a few different ways to do that. My Instagram is at Marissa, S-S-A, dot F, dot Cohen. My TikTok is Marissa F. Cohen. And my website is www.marissafaycohen.com. And if you want to know where in the world I am or what my schedule looks like, if you go to my speaking tab, I have a calendar front and center. It'll show you exactly where I am between now and forever.
Wonderful. If you ever get up to upstate New York and the upstate New York area, let me know.
I will be there in September.
Oh, wonderful.
Syracuse area, Syracuse, Cortland area.
But you're not that far from me. So hopefully we can meet up in person and maybe have some coffee or something.
I would love that. I'll be in touch.
Perfect. That sounds great. Marissa, thank you so much for being just a wonderful guest contributor to the podcast today. I enjoyed our conversation, and I know we're going to do this again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun, and I'm happy to come back anytime you'll have me.
And I'll take you up on that. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.